What's that? Well, maybe I am a little bit, but I love history myself. Okay, today we're going to continue our discussion of Greece, and today it's going to be pretty much a history lesson. So we're going to talk about Greece. Greece has a real fascinating period of history, though, and you really cannot understand the culture of the New Testament without understanding Hellenism and Grecian culture, so that's what we're going to look at today. And I want you to see the magnitude of this Grecian empire. And really what we're building towards is the Roman Empire here eventually, which is going to be our topic here probably next week. Now, we mentioned last week that there were two great divisions of Greek history. There was the period of early Greek history with the rise of the democracy, and then a second period with the rise of the Macedonians, namely under the leadership of Alexander the Great and his father Philip. But I'd like to spend a little bit of time talking about early Greek history. Now, I'm not going to spend a lot of time documenting everything that I say and really elaborating on it. I'm going to write down just some key points for you on the board, some key names, and then that's pretty much it. But basically, when you study early Greek history, it's characterized by war and great political strife. There were a lot of different tribes, a lot of different nationalities that moved into the land of Greece, and there was a lot of strife. Now, some of the early inhabitants of Greece are as follows, and I'm going to write these down on the board, but you don't necessarily have to learn them for a test or anything. But an early group would be the Aegeans. That would be one particular group. And then another group of ancient Greeks, the Minoans. So one would be the Aegeans, A-E-G-E-A-N-S, and then the Minoans, M-I-N-O-A-N-S, on the island of Crete. And the Minoans were a fairly highly advanced group of people. They had quite an extensive culture. And then about 1900 B.C., there was another group called the Achaeans. The Achaeans. So they were one further group. And then there was another one called the Dorians. The ancient Dorians are really prominent in ancient Greek history. So the Achaeans, A-C-H-A-E-A-N-S, and the Achaeans settled on the Greek peninsula. Their language developed into Greek. If you look on a map, when we talk about the peninsula, we're talking about this section right here. It's not a very good map of Greece, but this section right here would be called the peninsula. We might have a little bit better map here of the entire Mediterranean area. Right here, this is a lot better. Achaea is right down here. That's where they basically settled. And then the Dorians also entered. They moved into Greece. They spoke a form of Greece, or Greek, I should say. They were very hostile. They burned a number of the earlier cities. The Dorians were real warriors, real fighters. And they destroyed the culture that had been building for many years. And so the Dorians moved in. And then there was another group called the Ionians. They moved in as well. And that's spelled like this. And then also the Aeolians. A lot of different groups of people. The Ionians lived on the eastern side of the land of Greece. So that would be on this side right over here by the Aegean Sea. So they were one of the ancient peoples there. And then the Aeolians invaded and centered themselves in the middle portion of the land of Greece. So a lot of different tribes, a lot of different groups. And they're all warring, they're all fighting with each other. There's no real unity. And yet several of them actually spoke dialects of Greek. Well, then there's another major period of time that we come to, and this is called the Age of the Kings. And the Age of the Kings would be from about 1000 to 750 B.C. From 1000 to 750 B.C. And basically what happened was this. There were waves of new people that came down into the land of Greece, basically these different tribes. And they settled in all these little towns and villages in the valleys and in the plains between the mountains. And they were all separated from each other. And what happened is that these areas of settlement developed into what were called city-states. And each one of these city-states then were ruled over by kings. And so all these different cultures were kind of separated, and they grew and they developed, and eventually there were kings ruling over them. One of the real prominent ones, one, was the city of Athens. The city of Athens became a prominent city-state by about 700 B.C. And another one that became very prominent was the city of Sparta, and then the city of Corinth as well. And of course, most of those I think that you are familiar with, Athens and Corinth and Sparta. And the main thing about these city-states with their kings, they constantly quarrel. They constantly were warring with each other, and they were constantly fighting each other, even though they were separated from each other. And also, this was a time in which the Greeks developed a very distinctive culture. They had distinct patterns of art and distinct commerce. They carried on extensive trading throughout the Mediterranean Sea. In fact, as far as the British Isles, they were very notable sailors. Greek literature during this time flourished. Homer, the Greek poet, wrote his epic poems, the Iliad and the Odyssey, so on and so forth. And so even though they're warring and even though they're fighting, they, in a sense, are developing a Grecian culture during this time. Well, that led to the rise of the democracy. All this fighting, all this warring, led to the rise of the democracy. Gradually, the kings of the city-state were replaced by noblemen, nobles rather than kings. And I'm not sure the exact significance of all that, why they did that. But at any rate, the nobles weren't particularly the most favored rulers over the people, because the nobles enjoyed great wealth and great power at the expense of the peasants. And that always seems to happen. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And so the noblemen were ruling over the people. And by about 600 BC, the nobles all of a sudden vanished from the scene, and merchants began ruling over the city-state. So like there were prominent merchants in Athens and prominent merchants in Sparta, so on and so forth. And again, they were the most important leaders in the city-state, and their wealth consisted primarily of lands and slaves and money, again at the expense of the peasants. Well, finally, what happened? The people basically revolted against all these leaders, against the former kings and the merchants and the noblemen, and the city-states collected the citizens together, and the citizens passed laws to limit the power of the rulers and the power of the tyrants over them. So much so that by about 500 BC, democracy had a real stronghold in Greece. That was utterly unique in the ancient world. There was no such thing as democracy in Assyria or in Babylon or in Egypt. There was always a despot, or there was always a tyrant. There was always some king ruling over everyone and always exploiting the masses. And democracy was totally unique, and the reason why, it gave the citizens a voice in their own affairs. That was a real turn of events, utterly unique amongst the ancient world. And the Greeks were guaranteed civil liberties, and if you were a citizen, you were a free citizen, and also there were certain civic obligations that you had. You voted, you attended certain meetings, you took a concern, you participated in the government. That was a real difference. And what happened because of this democracy is that the Greek culture began to flourish, began to blossom. Things like poetry, things like architecture, sculpture, religion, philosophy, things like math, all those basic things that make an advanced culture all begin to flourish under democracy. I'm real convinced that democracy is one of the best means of developing the talents of an individual, because he's not punished. He's not punished for developing himself. It's not like over in Russia. If you live in Russia, you don't dare say anything out of the policy line. You don't dare disagree. You don't dare differ with anyone. In fact, all their leaders are all the same. They all say the same thing. The only way you can ever become a leader in Russia is to say the same thing, because they separate everyone that speaks differently from them. There's no way you can ever make it up through the ranks. That's why it's really far-fetched to believe that the present leader is going to be different than any of the others. They don't allow innovative, young, new ideas to come up through the ranks. They weed them all out. So they all speak the same way, they all say the same things, and you're punished for speaking your own ideas. And case in point would be men like Sakharov and Solzhenitsyn and others that had been punished in Russia for voicing their own opinions. But in Greek culture it was different. The people were actually able to voice their own opinions, and consequently all these different disciplines flourished. Well, then we come to a time and realize now, even up to this point in time, they're all still separated, all these city-states still warring with each other. Well, lo and behold, there was a period of brief unification of ancient Greece, where they unified themselves together. These city-states were extremely jealous of each other. Sparta was jealous of Athens, Athens was jealous of Thebes and Corinth, and so on and so forth, and they were all fiercely independent, but there were brief periods of time in which they did unite themselves together. Namely, to fight a common enemy. Namely, when a common enemy came down and threatened them and threatened their democracy, they were able to unite themselves together. Well, there was one common enemy that came to power. His name was Cyrus the Great. Remember him when we talked about him in connection with Persia? Well, Cyrus the Great came to the throne, and his entire goal was to conquer all of Asia Minor and march over and begin to conquer Europe, and to begin to conquer Greece. That was his great goal. That's what he sought to do. And so Cyrus the Great came to power, and he made Persia the strongest power in the world. It was amazing what he did. And so the Persians began to march against Greece, and in 490 BC, the Persians attempted to invade Greece, but they were actually defeated. This was a turn of events, because the Persians weren't used to defeat. But they were defeated by the Greeks and by Athens at the Battle of Marathon. That was a real unique, real turn of events. And so Persia invaded again, and this time they invaded by land and by sea. And they felt like, we're not going to lose this time. And the Spartans battled them at the Battle of Thermopylae, and there were some other significant battles and so on and so forth. And the Persians were able to conquer them at times, and partially. But at any rate, Athens made a league with all the other city-states, and Athens, along with the other city-states, were able to inflict a number of crushing blows against the Persians. And the tide of power began to turn real slowly, began to turn from the Persians to the Greeks. Let me relate one interesting account here to you. There was one Persian ruler, his name was Xerxes, and he marched toward Europe. He was a Persian king with a staggering fighting force that Herodotus puts at about 2,641,610 men. That's 2.5 million. Now, that's larger or as large as the armed forces of the United States. If you took all the armed forces of the United States, all of it, right now, that's about how large that army is. That's a huge army. And they also had 1,207 more ships and 3,000 smaller vessels. So they were attacking Greece by land and by sea. Well, this king called Xerxes reached an area called the Hellespont. It's this little area right here on, what's the name of this ocean again? You had to study it. It slips my mind. Propontis. Right here on Propontis. And as they're marching across, they come to this area of the Hellespont in which it's open water. It's a channel. And they had to march across it. And so Xerxes ordered a bridge to be built across it to get his troops across it. So they took all these little vessels and they lashed them together. And they tied them all together for mile after mile to cross the Hellespont, to march all the troops across. Well, they got the bridge all built, and all of a sudden, a storm came up. And when the storm came up, it blew all the ships apart. And so what Xerxes did, he was full of wrath against the Hellespont. So he gave orders that the Hellespont should receive 300 lashes. And they took their whips out, and they whipped the water 300 times, and they slashed it 300 times. And then they took a pair of fetters, like handcuffs, and they threw it into the water of the Hellespont to bind the power of the Hellespont, to handcuff its power. And then on top of that, they took branding irons, and they branded the Hellespont. They heated up their irons, and they branded it as belonging to the Persian Empire. Never again will the Hellespont break apart a bridge like that. And then as they lashed the water with their whips, they uttered wicked and barbarous words, the historians tell us. And then also Xerxes ordered that the overseers of the work should lose their heads as well. So all the leaders, all the supervisors lost their heads for building a bridge that did not work. But at any rate, the Persians, they were determined that they were going to get over to Greece and conquer the land of Greece. Now, I'm not sure what the Hellespont felt about all this. I imagine it probably didn't really care too much about it, as far as, you know, the oaths and everything uttered against it from the Persians. Now, after this was all said and done, and basically what it boils down to is the Persians kind of half conquered the Greeks, never fully conquered them, never really retained power over them, and it's kind of like the Persians retreated for a little while to think about things for a while, because they lost a number of significant battles. Well, what happened is, because the Greeks weren't fighting the Persians, they started fighting themselves again. And what erupted was a period called the Peloponnesian Wars. Kind of reminds me a lot of the church. When the church is being beaten up by the devil, the church will fight against the devil. You know, they'll join ranks and fight against the devil. But when the devil kind of hangs loose and doesn't beat up on the church, then the church starts fighting itself often. That's a great ploy of the devil. Well, what happened with the Peloponnesian Wars was this. Athens had primarily led the victory over Persia. They were kind of the strongest city-state and the strongest forest. And so they became the dominant force of Greece. Well, all the other city-states were very jealous of all this. And Sparta resented this. And together with the other city-states, they began to oppose Athens. And there was a series of battles that erupted called the Peloponnesian Wars. P-E-L-O-P-O-N-N-E-S-I-A-N. Peloponnesian Wars. And all these city-states are warring and battling each other. And ironically, this period is also called the Golden Age of Athens. Even though Athens was at war, still Athens, as far as a culture, flourished. This is the time of great architecture. This is the time in which they built the Acropolis and the Parthenon. If you've ever seen ancient pictures of their Greek temple and their fortress and everything, that primarily is a snapshot, possibly, of Athens. It's real famous. It's still there today, what's left of it. Greek authors flourished during this time, Sophocles and Euripides. Philosophy flourished under Socrates, who was an Athenian. And so the culture of Athens was flourishing. The Athenian navy ruled the Aegean Sea with great power and wealth. Well, finally, in 404 BC, Athens fell. Athens collapsed to Sparta. And then what happened is Thebes turned around and defeated Sparta. So it's like Athens was defeated by Sparta, and then Sparta was defeated by Thebes, and eventually all of Greece lay in disunity. That's pretty much how it was. The entire situation was just one of great disunity. And that made them very, very vulnerable to external conquest. This was their downfall as far as being separate city-states and everything. And the city-states of Greece were now pretty much second-rate powers with a very, very uncertain future. Well, enter another major historical facet now in our story, and this is the rise of the ancient Macedonians. The Macedonians now come to power. That's spelled Macedonians, the Macedonians. And actually, while all this war was going on between Persia and the city-states of Greece, there was a growing power to the north of the land of Greece, the land of Macedonia, which really is not a Greek land. It was a separate culture. The Macedonians, right up here to the north, were growing in power, growing in strength. Macedonia actually had a very slow development. It was kind of pretty much a rural state, a rural country. No one ever really looked at it as far as being a powerful state. It was a peasant state. And all of a sudden, it began to build into a military state. And it went from a purely rural to a more urbanized state and a more military state. And notably, there was one leader. His name was Philip II. Philip II. Philip II reigned from 359 to 336. 359 to 336. He was the king of Macedonia. And he was a very, very powerful king. And he did a couple of things. He combined savagery. His troops were savage. That's really what they were. They were fighters. And he combined that with Hellenistic culture. Now, they themselves were not Greeks. Hellenism is Greek culture. So he combined Greek culture together with great savagery. And what he did, he built it into a very effective power. And within 2 years, he cleared the entire land of Macedonia of all invaders. And within 2 years, he began the formation of the finest army the world had ever seen. No one had ever seen an army like the army that Philip of Macedonia built. And what he did, he drew men from a number of various subject states and throughout all of Macedonia, and he instilled within them a spirit of nationalism, very much like what Adolf Hitler did. Adolf Hitler was so successful because he instilled within the Germans a spirit of nationalism. And they became very nationalistic. The Germans began to feel like, this is the Reich. It will last for 1,000 years. We will conquer the world. We are the supreme people. We are the elite. We are God's ordained. With Adolf Hitler, our Führer, and so on and so forth, and the Aryan people, we will conquer the world. Well, Philip did that very similarly. He took all these Macedonians and instilled within them the spirit of nationalism. He also developed new methods of warfare that we're going to talk briefly about here in a few minutes, namely the phalanx method of warfare. Well, in 357 BC, he took the area on his eastern frontier. So this area right up over in this area right here, of the land of Greece, he began to conquer. So he actually began to conquer Greece itself. And a year later, he began the conquest of the middle portion of Greece. And Athens did try to set itself against Philip, but even mighty Athens fell and was crushed in 338 BC, and Athens lay at the feet of Philip. And 1 year later, Philip summoned all the city-states south of Thermopylae. Thermopylae was a city right here, almost smack dab in the middle of Greece. But he summoned all the city-states south of Thermopylae to send delegates to a special council, in which he offered them the option, saying basically, I've conquered all of Greece so far. I've conquered Athens. I've conquered all the most powerful city-states. And you have the option to either join us or we will conquer you. And pretty much everyone complied but Sparta. And Sparta refused to comply. Sparta was rebellious. But before Philip could execute his plan of warfare against the rest of Greece and then eventually against Persia, he all of a sudden was murdered. And he was no longer there. And so things were kind of in a state of flux for a very short period of time until there was a blazing comet that came to power whose name was Alexander the Great. And Alexander the Great was his son. And Alexander came to power in 336 BC. And he assumed the reins of government at the ripe old age of 20. He was 20 years old when he came to power. Probably there's a couple young men in here about 20 years of age. And stop and think about you being 20 years old and taking under your wing, as it were, one of the most powerful armies in the world. And actually going out and marching and conquering the entire world. Never knowing defeat. Never knowing the taste of defeat. That's what happened to Alexander. Alexander is a very interesting man. Well, I want to tell you a little bit about him. Alexander, of course, was the son of Philip II, and so therefore had been trained by his father as far as military warfare. So it's not like when he came to power he was totally ignorant. He wasn't. He was a general by virtue of that term and in his own rank. And he actually studied under the Athenian philosopher Aristotle for a number of years. In fact, when he was 14 years old, he was doled out to Aristotle. And Aristotle was Alexander's personal tutor. Aristotle was a man that lived from 384 to 322. Maybe I should write Aristotle's name down here on the board. I know that you've all probably heard of Aristotle. Aristotle lived from 384 to 322 BC. That's spelled A-R-I-S-T-O-T-L-E. And Aristotle himself had been the student of Plato, had sat at the feet of Plato, learned from Plato. And so Aristotle was very studied in the areas of philosophy, things like botany, geography, zoology, astronomy, art, all those major disciplines. He was very studied. In fact, the man was probably a genius. And in fact, so great was the influence of Aristotle that in the 12th and 13th century AD now, the Catholic Church basically regarded his teachings as being divinely inspired. And in fact, that was where they ran into a lot of problem, because St. Thomas Aquinas and others drew very heavily from the teachings of Aristotle. And Aristotle certainly was not inspired of God. It was all pagan philosophy and so on and so forth. But anyway, through Aristotle, Alexander acquired a very, very deep love for Hellenistic culture. Hellenistic culture is talking about Greek culture. Even though Alexander was not technically a Greek, he was a Greek by culture. And he was a Greek by the nationalism that he received from the Greek culture. So he acquired a very, very deep love for Hellenistic culture. And in fact, this actually drove him to the Far East to conquer Persia and even to conquer India, if he could, in order to spread what he called Hellenism. That was really his whole goal. He felt like he was ordained of the gods to spread Hellenism, to spread culture. And the Greeks looked at the Persians as being very barbaric, very crude, very ignorant. You probably have heard that term Hellenism before. It's spelled H-E-L-L-E-N-I-S-M. And Alexander the Great felt like, this is my calling, to spread Hellenism. And actually, he called himself a Messiah. Felt like he was a Messiah. He was a Savior that was sent to spread Hellenism throughout the world. Now, let me tell you a little bit about Hellenism, because Alexander was the great proponent of it. When Alexander marched with his army, he was accompanied by a very illustrious group, very distinguished group of philosophers and literary men and scientists and botanists and geographers. He marched with all these men. And everywhere he went, he planted Hellenism. He left behind cities. He left behind the Greek culture. So let me tell you a little bit about Hellenism, because you can't understand Alexander the Great without knowing something about Hellenism. You see, way back when the Macedonians originally conquered the Greeks, the Macedonians decided that the best way to conquer the Greeks would be to absorb their culture and to absorb their language. And that's what Philip did. Philip the Great absorbed all the Greek culture and all the Greek language. And the Greek language was adopted as the official language of the state of Macedonia and Greece under Philip, and then later under Alexander. And so for the first time in history, this united the Grecian Empire under one common language, because up to that point in time, all these different groups of people had their own dialects of Greek, just like there's different dialects of German. And in fact, some dialects of some foreign languages are so different, even though it's the same language, you can't even understand someone with a different dialect. That's the way it was with Greece. The Dorians had their dialect, the Aeolians had theirs, but they were all united into one common language called the Koine Greek. Koine, or common Greek. Maybe I should write that down here for you too. One common language. Obviously, it's kind of hard to control troops if they can't understand each other. So they had one common language, Koine Greek, that's spelled K-O-I-N long E. The word Koine means common, common. So it was a common language, common Greek language. And so when Alexander marched, he took the Koine language with him, and he influenced and left behind Greek culture behind him everywhere he conquered. So Hellenism is the spread and the development of Greek culture throughout the world. And that's just what Alexander did. As he conquered, he spread the Greek culture. All the Greek cultural achievements that reached their highest point in Athens, well, Alexander felt like, that is my duty to spread all this throughout the world. So really, it was much more than an ego trip when Alexander went to conquer the world. It was a real calling. He felt like, this is a real destiny that I am ordained to. Now, what this included then was things like language, arts. They spread the arts throughout the world. Philosophy. The commerce of Greece spread throughout the world as Alexander conquered the world. Government, namely democracy. And that was so effective that it actually spread to America, to the colonies. The democracy that we have, it's traced all the way back to Greece and all the way back to ancient Rome. Athletics, the Greeks were very big on the Olympics, and that has spread. So all these different thoughts now. In fact, a lot of people aren't aware that our English language has come, much of it, from Latin and from ancient Greece. In fact, all the following words, and these are just a few out of several hundred words that we've gotten right from the Greek language, all the following words I'm going to read to you have all come from the Greek language. And if you were to see the Greek word, it's spelled almost exactly the same way as these English words are. Let me give you a little list. What I want you to see is how effectively Alexander spread this Greek culture, because it spread throughout all the Mediterranean world, throughout all of Asia Minor, all the way down into Palestine, all the way down into Egypt, all throughout Persia, and even eventually spread to even North America. Yes. a list of English words. You don't need to write these down, but these are all English words taken right from the Greek language. And I want you to see how Hellenism has even spread to America. But the word gymnastic, gymnasium, athlete, acrobat, music, melody, harmony, symphony, anthem, doxology, organ, comedy, rhythm, politics, policy, economic, ethnic, monarchy, tyranny, democracy, anarchy, patriot, hero, cosmopolitan, theater, rhetoric, monopoly, mathematics, geometry, arithmetic, cone, cube, sphere, poetry, poet, drama, tragedy, scene, theme, so on and so forth. All those words have come directly from the Greek language. So in a sense, we speak a portion of Greek, even in the English language over here in America. Well, anyway, let's back up a little bit in our story. At the death of the father... Alexander, when Philip died, all of a sudden Alexander was made the new Macedonian king, just overnight, pretty much. And Alexander promptly set his house in order. He did not delay, and he went throughout the land of Greece. He consolidated his empire, and there was one last city-state that tried to rebel against him, Thebes. So Alexander went down and promptly crushed that city, Thebes, as an object lesson to any other city-states that might rebel against him. And that gave him full control over all the entire Grecian empire. And by the spring of 334 BC, he set his face to invade the Persian Empire. And this was a real turn of events, because the Persians, for a long, long period of time, for over 100 years now, for probably about 150 years, the Persians had been trying to invade Greece. And Greece had always been the underdog, and they were still considered to be the underdog. But all of a sudden, Alexander the Great reversed the whole thing, and he's going to start invading Greece, and the gods, as it were, are with him. And it was a real war of revenge against the giant of the East. Now, before we talk about him conquering Persia, let me tell you a little bit about Greek war tactics, because this is what made Alexander so powerful and so effective. First of all, the ancient Greeks raised their children to be soldiers, especially in Athens and in Sparta. In Sparta, this was very, very true. In Sparta, children belonged to the state. They did not belong to the parents. And at a very young age, when a young child was, let's say, maybe 6 or 7 years old, he was taken from his fathers, from his father and mother, and given to the state and raised by the state to be a soldier. Defective boys were thrown out on the hills to die. The strong ones were taken and they were educated by the state. Most of the education was physical. The young boys were taught to run, to wrestle, to endure pain without flinching, to never cry, to live on reduced rations, to obey commands without any question. They were taught to rule. They were taught nobility. They were taught courage. And they were also taught things like mathematics and philosophy and a love of reading. And so they were very, very carefully trained like this. So by the time you were 14 or 15 years old, just as a young man now, just as a teenager, you were a very formidable soldier, even at that young age. Well, then under Philip and Alexander, the Greeks implemented what was called the phalanx method of warfare, which was really unique to the ancient world. The phalanx method of warfare. That's spelled P-H-A-L-A-N-X. And let me tell you a little bit about this. Alexander did not have a lot of men to work with as far as the number of men in his troops, and so he had to utilize every single man, and they developed this phalanx. Now, there were 9,000 men in a single phalanx. And what they took all these 9,000 men, and they divided them into squares with 16 men to each side. So like you had 9,000 men in a phalanx, and then this in turn was divided up into all these little squares with 16 men on each side of the square. And each man was protected with full armor. The Greeks had very fine armor. They had helmets. They had shields. They had armor that covered their breasts and covered their loins and covered their calves and covered their shins. And so they had full armor, and they had 13-foot-long spears, as well as cavalry troops and archers and so forth. But the common soldier had a 13-foot-long spear, and they stood about 3 feet away from each other, and they locked their shields to each other, and they extended their spears right out through the middle of their shields like that. So like you've got these all these different squares, 16 men on a side, consisting of 9,000 total men, and what they did, they put their shields in place, and they formed human tanks. And they would run, they were trained very carefully to turn, and they could turn at commands, they ran straight ahead, they turned like on a dime, and they went all these different directions, and they would come against the enemy like tanks. And the Persian method of warfare, what they did, they just lined up in a big line. They had a big line, they had battle elephants, and they had all their archers, and they had all their spearmen and everything. And all of a sudden the Greeks came, and the Greeks were coming from all different directions, and they were like these tanks with all their shields, and all their armor and everything. And the Persians would be routed, be divided, be conquered, and the Greeks would come like in a wedge formation, split them apart, and split them apart again, and attack them from behind, and attack them from the side, attack them from the front. And the Persians didn't know really how to cope with that. And then Alexander, furthermore, had war machines. They were the MX missiles of the day, and they were designed by Diades, who was a Greek engineer, and the Persians hadn't seen machines like this before. They were huge catapults and etc., and they could shoot huge arrows, or they could hurl like 50-pound boulders for like 200 yards. So all of a sudden, you've got these boulders that are coming down on top of your head, big 50-pound rocks crashing down on you. And then Alexander also carried huge towers with them that they could dismantle. And actually the towers, they had wheels on them. And they could put these towers together, push them up against the wall of the city, climb up over the wall, and drop down into the enemy, behind the enemy's walls, so that they could scale the enemy's walls. And they could travel very quickly. They never, they didn't travel like the Romans did. They traveled real quickly. They lived off the land, and they plundered cities as they conquered cities. And so they could move very rapidly, and they didn't have a huge force. They had only about 40,000 men, all total. And so they moved around very rapidly like this, and the men were so carefully trained and so disciplined that they could withstand all the rigors of warfare. And then also, Alexander was a master of propaganda. And he had this particular custom that he loved. What he'd do, he'd send spies into the enemy territory, and they would leave behind these enormous horse bits. I mean, these things were huge. They were just monsters. It looked like the horses were maybe 15 feet tall or something. And they left behind these horse bits, and the enemy would come out and they'd see these horse bits, and they knew that they belonged to Alexander the Great, and they felt like Alexander has got horses like that, 15 feet tall? And so therefore there was fear struck in their heart before they even saw Alexander the Great, and it gave the impression that he had these giant horses. So a combination of all these different tactics and all the different skill of Alexander the Great enabled him to conquer the whole world. Well, that brings us up to our next point. Alexander led an army of 40,000 men. Now realize, the Persians had marched across with 2.5 million men and were basically defeated by the Greeks. Now Alexander marches back with 40,000 men. That's just a pittance compared to 2.5 million. Well, he marched across with 40,000 men across the Dardanelles and the Hellespont into Asia Minor, and he encountered the Persians at what is called the Granicus River, which I'm not sure if it's marked on our map, but it's here in Asia Minor, and he defeated them. He defeated the Persians at the Granicus River, and lo and behold, one victory led to another, 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 until the entire Persian Empire was conquered by him. And so from Asia Minor, he moved on to northern Syria, and there he defeated the Persians at Issus. This is right north of Palestine now. And from Issus in Syria, he marched down south, and he conquered Tyre, he conquered Phoenicia, he conquered all of Palestine, he marched all the way down into Egypt, he conquered all the Egyptians, and actually they welcomed him as a conqueror, because they didn't like the Persians, and so they claimed that he was the son of the god Amun-Re. Remember Amun-Re? Well, he occurs again, and now they're calling Alexander the Great Amun-Re. And he consequently conquered them, and he founded the city of Alexandria, built that city, left it behind as a model of Hellenism. And then he set his face northward again, and he marched through the land of Syria back again. He'd already conquered them. And finally, he faced the Persians at one final showdown. It was called the Battle of Arbela or Guagamela, just depending on what map you look on. And that was in 331 B.C. The Battle of Arbela. In 331 B.C. And he encountered a king called Darius III at Arbela in 331. That's spelled A-R-B-E-L-A, or Guagamela. And Darius faced Alexander with a great line of battle elephants. He put everything that he had on it, and he had a huge, huge number. The Greeks were greatly outnumbered, and it was a very long, very bitter battle. But due to the methods of Greek warfare, the Greeks defeated them. And not only so, when the battle was over, there were 600,000 Persians laying dead on the battlefield. 600,000. And realize now that the Greeks started with 40,000. And that shows you how feisty they were. Shows you how good they were. 600,000 Persians, according to the historians, were killed. Well, after the Battle of Guagamela or Arbela, Alexander was crowned the king of Asia, of all of Asia. And Alexander then swept south, and he took Babylon, and he successively conquered the Persian capitals of Susa, Persepolis, and Ecbatana, all within 4 months, conquered all the capitals of Persia. And so Alexander became the king of Persia, and now he was pretty much the king of the world. He was the most powerful ruler, and now he's only in his early 30s now. By this time, it's taken him about maybe 10 years to conquer the whole world like this. And instead of consolidating his conquest, which is what he probably should have done, he decided to conquer India. And that wasn't too popular with his troops. They were pretty war-weary by now, you can imagine, after 10 years of constant battling. But he actually marched towards India, and he encountered the enemy at a number of places like the Indus Valley, and he was actually fairly successful. But then there were some defeats that came along the way, and his troops were so war-weary, they refused to go any farther. It's like Alexander was thinking, as long as there's another country, I've got to conquer it. He was obsessed. He could not stop. He had to conquer the entire world, everywhere he went. Also, during this time, historians say that Alexander underwent some real deep personal changes. I think all this victory began to get to his head. I think he got a bloated opinion of himself. But he actually began to adopt Persian and Oriental costumes. He began to dress like the Persians. He married an Oriental. He also required that his troops worship him, that they lay down before him and worship him. And they really objected to that because they did not believe that he was a god. He started feeling like he was a god. He started feeling like people should worship him. And that greatly disturbed the troops. They were intensely loyal to him. They loved him. They had been with him through battle after battle, and he himself was very valiant in the battle. He was right in the midst of all the frays and everything. And yet, all of his troops began to become very disturbed, you can imagine, began to kind of feel like Alexander is off his rocker, all this victory has gotten to him. And they still did not rebel against him. And so finally, they marched all the way back to Babylon, and Alexander was a little disappointed that they hadn't conquered India. And then finally, he died at the age of 33 years old, there in the city of Babylon, while planning further conquests. And he died basically of malaria, aggravated by reckless habits of eating and drinking. He was a real drinker. And whenever they had a victory, of course, he would go on a big drunken spiel with all the men. And they would live off all the plunder, and they would eat, and they would riot, and they would live it up and banquet, and that's the way he lived. And at 33 years old, he died. Well, let me tell you a little bit about the influence of Alexander the Great. The influence of Alexander the Great is not just limited to his abilities as a military commander, but the primary thing connected with him is the spread of Hellenization everywhere. He founded Greek cities everywhere he went. He allowed them to be self-governing. A Greek thought spread throughout the world. The Greek language spread throughout the world. Greek art was spread everywhere throughout Southwest Asia. Koine became the language of the world, the language of literature, the language of commerce, all the way from the Tigris River to the Mediterranean Ocean, which incidentally opened up the door for the entire gospel to be spread throughout the world, because that gave a common language when Jesus came and the disciples followed Jesus. They, of course, spoke Koine Greek, so they could therefore go throughout the world and preach the gospel. Well, we're going to talk about what happened to Greece here after the death of Alexander in just a moment. Let me read a little poem to you about Jesus and Alexander. It's kind of interesting when you compare Jesus Christ to Alexander the Great. They had two different motivations motivating them, didn't they? They had two different goals. They were laboring for two different kingdoms. Well, it says, Jesus and Alexander died at 33. Isn't it interesting? They both died at the same age. One lived and died for self. One died for you and me. The Greek died on a throne. The Jew died on a cross. One's life a triumph seemed, the other but a loss. One led vast armies forth, the other walked alone. One shed a whole world's blood, the other gave his own. One won the world in life and lost it all in death, the other lost his life to bring the whole world faith. Jesus and Alexander died at 33. One died in Babylon and one at Calvary. One gained all for himself and one himself he gave. One conquered every throne, the other every grave. The one made himself God, the other dwelt homeless. The one lived but to blast, the other but to bless. When died the Greek, forever fell his sword, but Jesus died to live forever, Lord of lords. Jesus and Alexander died at 33. The Greek made all men slaves, the Jew made all men free. One built a throne on blood, the other built on love. The one was born of earth, the other from above. One won all the earth to lose all earth and heaven. The other gave all, up all, and all to him was given. The Greek forever died, the Jew forever lives. He loses all who gets and wins all things who gives. Isn't that a true picture of Alexander and Jesus Christ? It is true. Well, anyway, let's back up and let's talk about Alexander the Great. What happened to him after his death now? Well, you know what happened to him after his death. But let's talk about what happened to his kingdom. I wouldn't want to stand before that Ancient of Days, even if I was Alexander the Great, not knowing Yahweh as my Savior. And that's exactly what happened to him. But for about 50 years after Alexander died, his empire was torn apart by his ambitious generals, all seeking control. He had four primary generals that were vying for power. Of course, no one ever expected that Alexander would die. He was only 33 years old. He seemed to be immortal. He seemed to be immutable. He seemed like he would never be conquered. And all of a sudden, he was dead. And everyone, of course, was flabbergasted, as far as Greeks were concerned. But Daniel gave a prophecy of this whole thing, and I'd like to read it to you. Back in the book of Daniel, chapter 8, verses 3 through 8. Daniel chapter 8, and verses 3 through 8, it says this. Very interesting prophecy. This is a prophecy of the Grecian Empire conquering the Persian Empire, and then the Grecian Empire splitting up into four separate empires. But chapter 8 and verse 3, "Then I lifted up mine eyes, and I saw, and behold, there stood before the river a ram, which had two horns. And the two horns were high, but the one was higher than the other, and the higher came up last." Now that's a vision of Persia. The ram represents Persia. The two horns represent Medo and Persia itself. And you'll notice that one was higher, and it came up last. That's talking about the kingdom of Persia. It came up last, and it defeated Media. It says in verse 4, "And I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward, so that no beast might stand before him, neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand, but he did according to his will and became great." Talking about Persia conquering the world. No one could deliver themselves from the hand of Persia. "And as I was considering, behold, an he-goat came from the west on the face of the whole earth and touched not the ground." This is Alexander the Great and the Greeks now, coming as a he-goat. "And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes." That represents Alexander, that horn right in the middle of the he-goat. And it says in verse 6, "And he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing before the river, and ran onto him in the fury of his power. And I saw him come close onto the ram, and he was moved with choler," that's an old word for hatred, "against him, and smote the ram and brake his two horns, and there was no power in the ram to stand before him, but he cast him down to the ground and stamped upon him, and there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hand. Therefore the he-goat waxed very great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken." Boy, what a prophecy. How accurate, how amazing. First of all, Alexander conquered the world in 10 years. It's a he-goat running and not even touching the ground. It's like a he-goat with missiles on his feet or something. Just conquering the world like that. And he comes to the ram, he comes to Medo-Persia, filled with hatred, charges into this ram, and just crushes him in the fury of his power. But then it says down in verse 8, when the he-goat was very powerful, very strong, then the great horn was broken. Alexander died. And for it came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven, and out of one of them came forth a little horn. Those four little horns that came forth from the great horn were the four generals that took over Alexander the Great's empire. Cassander, Lysimachus, Ptolemy, and Seleucus. Each one of those represents a horn. Realize that Daniel is getting this vision. Well, let me see. He's getting this vision way back in 555 BC, a couple hundred years before this happened. Here are the four generals that replaced Alexander the Great. Cassander reigned over Macedonia and Greece. Cassander is spelled C-A-S-A-N-D-E-R. The second one is Lysimachus. That's spelled L-Y-S-I-M-A-C-H-U-S. Lysimachus ruled over Thrace and Bithynia. Thrace is this area right up in here, and Bithynia is this area of Asia Minor. So that's where Lysimachus ruled over. The third one is Ptolemy. Ptolemy received Egypt, was able to conquer Egypt. Ptolemy is spelled P-T-O-L-E-M-Y. And then the fourth one is Seleucus. He's the fourth general. And that's spelled S-E-L-E-U-C-U-S, Seleucus. Seleucus controlled Syria and Palestine and Babylonia and Persia. So really the Middle East, you might say, but Syria, Palestine, Babylonia, and Persia. And so really what you end up with then is really almost a second-rate power, because these generals were not friends, they were enemies. And actually they battled against each other. There's that old spirit in them again, the Greeks just vying against each other. Now that the Persians are conquered, might as well fight each other, see? And that's basically what happened. And so their kingdom became weaker and weaker until they finally fell to Rome. Yes. Okay, he ruled over Egypt, right? The Ptolemies, and then they're called the Seleucidae, plural, ruled over the land of Palestine and Syria. And we're going to talk about those tomorrow real briefly. But basically, because of all the conflict and all the division, and the Greeks weren't keeping their eyes on Rome, and Rome is the growing power right now, see? And Rome was growing in power, and it was not long before they encountered Rome. Conflict was really inevitable. Rome finally went to war against Macedonia in 200 BC and began to conquer the Greeks in that area. Rome defeated them after 4 years, and Macedonia fell to Roman power. Now, it took the Romans a little while to work their way all the way down through Palestine. In fact, it took them almost 150 years to get all the way down to Palestine. But they conquered Macedonia first, and from this point in time then, the Romans are the world empire. And the tide of power is passing. The baton of glory is passing on to the Romans and has gone from the hands of the Greeks. Yes.
What was the area over the two first generals?
Okay. The first one, Cassander, ruled over Macedonia and Greece, and Lysimachus ruled over Thrace and Bithynia. Yes. Okay. Well, actually, I've really read in a lot of different sources, and I'm not even sure I can tell you all the sources I've really read in, but a real good one is Wycliffe's Historical Geography again. And Wycliffe has a chapter on every single empire that I've talked about. And some of our information we've gotten right from Wycliffe's, and in fact, all this information that I've given you, you can pretty much find in Wycliffe's Historical Geography, that one volume. And then there's even a lot more information in there. So Wycliffe's Historical Geography is a real, real good source. And then another source I read from a lot is just the World Book Encyclopedia and the Encyclopedia Britannica. So I read those sources too. They're real good for this type of history. And then I've got some other historical references too. But probably Wycliffe's is the best. It's really hard when you study these ancient empires and you're just lecturing. It's real hard for the student to they can write down the key thoughts pretty much, and that's about it. If you want to fill in your understanding, well, you can read in Wycliffe, and that will be real helpful for you. You mean last time in class?
Yeah.
Well, we'll just mark.
Yeah.
We'll just. I'm looking at Kathy's lead. Your name was there, but I want Connie. I was wondering, it didn't seem right. Okay, so you're standing right here, Connie.